Welcome, everyone. Today we're going to be exploring the topic of the Goanim, or at least beginning our exploration of this time period. And we're going to divide our study of the period of the Goanim into a few sections. We'll start with a quick introduction, a little bit of background based on last time's class. They will then give a little bit of an overview of the leadership structure of the community, look at a really interesting text. One particular text that I think just gives us a sense, a real texture of the time period. And then finally, we'll begin to explore today at least some of the outstanding figures of this time period. Next time, God willing, we'll continue and conclude our overview of those personalities. And then we'll look at a few other key issues at this time period, including the internal fissure within the Jewish community, the controversy or the debate between the polemics, really back and forth between the Rabbinites and the Karaites, and a few other dimensions of this time period. And then toward the conclusion of this time period, we'll start to trace the immigration or the migration of the Jewish community from the area of modern-day Iraq, from Babylonia toward North Africa, which becomes even more of a center toward the end of the Goanic period, beginning of the period of the Rishonim, places like Fez, where the Rif was, as we'll discuss, places like Tunisia, where Ravinu Hanana lived, and then ultimately up toward the Spanish community of Spain, as that in turn becomes the key center of the Sephardic Jewish community toward the classical period, or the later period of medieval period, first starting with the Golden Age of Spain, so-called, from 950 to 1150, roughly, and then we'll look at the Spanish Jewish community as it transitions from Islamic rule to the Reconquista, to Christian rule, and see some of the dramatic changes that the community undergoes. And then eventually we'll conclude our discussion of Sfarad with the Spanish expulsion of 1492, and then we'll turn back to the Ashkenazi communities subsequent to that. So that's going to be essentially our plan. In terms of the overall structure of the course, and in particular our examination of the period of the Goanim, which we're going to be beginning today. Just to circle back and to start with some of that background. So we had mentioned last time that this community is really, in many ways, an organic continuation of a Jewish presence that had been in Babylonia since really the time of just before, and then throughout the period of the Churban, or the immediate aftermath of the Churban Bayis Rishon. So we're going quite some time back. And yet, this is a community that undergoes some very substantial transition in the early parts of the 7th century with the rise of Islam. In particular, prior to the rise of Islam and ending sometime around that point, we know that the Jewish community had really the intellectual efforts of the community at that time had been focused on the Chasimas HaTalmud. The core of the Talmud Bavli had been, the editing had been concluded around the year 450, 500 of the Common Era. Classically attributed to Ravina and Rav Ashi, and yet then we have what in traditional Jewish circles is known as the period of the Savoraim. Many academic scholars don't necessarily view the period of the Savoraim as a distinct time period, and yet whatever exactly we call it, the truth is that this period is a period of time that's shrouded in some degree of relative mystery. We don't necessarily know all that much about this time period. But essentially, for our purposes, let's just take for granted that the Gemara is refined, it is clarified. The basic explanation of the Gemara, the basic sort of the final version, roughly, of the Gemara is really firmed up. And then by the time we pick it up at the beginning of the Gaonic period, essentially we have the Talmud Bavli as the canonized text of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the Oral Torah, And in terms of the community leadership, right, we find ourselves under Islamic rule, and yet continuing with the basic structure which had existed for quite some time. Religiously speaking, we have the classical yeshivot of Sura and Pumbedisa, and at the head of each of those respective yeshivot, we have what now becomes called the Gaon. The genius, the great scholar, and we're going to be looking at the various Gaonic leaders of those respective yeshivot. And one of the interesting things that we'll pick up on is that at various points over the course of the history of this Jewish community, the respective stature of these two yeshivot really goes up and down, ascends and descends in terms of its respective stature. So there are times when Sura is the most outstanding of the yeshivot. There are times when Pumbedisa is most prominent, but these really are the two central loci of the Jewish community at this time. And each, interestingly enough, in order to perhaps make things a little bit more manageable in terms of the division of religious leadership, really each yeshiva had under its penumbra sort of an umbrella of communities that would turn their questions to those respective yeshiva. The yeshivot are actually quite interesting in that they were most active during 2 months of the year, namely the months of Adar and Elul. There was a system that was put in place at this time known as the Yarchei Kala, the Kala, and essentially many of the farmers and budding scholars would take off time from work during these periods of the planting and harvest season that were a little bit lighter. And at this time, many of those students would travel to the respective yeshivot of Sura and Pumbedisa for a time period of intensive learning, of intensive immersive study. One of the interesting aspects of this study was really the course of study, the structure of the learning. What had happened was that over the course of the year, very often there were numerous she'elot, halachic queries that were posed to the geonim in each of the respective yeshivot. And over the course of the kala, of the month of learning that would take place at the yeshiva, essentially much of the study would be dedicated toward a clarification of the various questions that had been posed to the Gaon over the course of that previous period of time. And so they would examine the sugyot, and they would study them very carefully, and they would attempt to arrive at a conclusive ruling with regard to that particular shaila. The students would learn the sugya together with the gaon, make a recommendation. The gaon would form up his own position with regard to the question, and ultimately, after the course of the learning, they would produce at that time or a little bit later a document which is signed by the Gaon, essentially is the answer to the question. This is, of course, a genre of writing that's quite familiar to us, and we call it She'elot U'Tshuvot, Responsa. The Gaonic period was really, the early Gaonic period in particular, was really a time which was the source, is considered by scholars to be the time during which the responsa literature really came into its own and really developed into a full-fledged genre in its own right. And very often it's to these courses of study during the kalas and the halachic answers, the halachic solutions, responses that were developed in the course of that study and then sent to the various constituent communities that really is considered to be really the flowering of the She'elot U'Tshuvot literature. So that's just a quick word about the religious leadership structure in terms of the yeshivot. And alongside the yeshivot, we also have the position in terms of the political leadership of the community, specifically the exilarch, the Resh Galuta. Of course, the Resh Galuta, just as the yeshivot of Sura and Pumbedisa were long-standing institutions in Babel, so too the position of the Resh Galuta was certainly a long-standing one as well. What's very interesting, and this will become evident in the text that we're going to be looking at today a little bit, is that during the Islamic period in particular, the structure or the or numerous aspects of the Reish Galuta's role really were cast in ways that were consistent with and comfortable with Jews of Islamic lands. So the text we're going to be looking at is specifically called the Installation of the Exilarch. It's a classic medieval Jewish source that many have looked at. It's produced by Rabbi Natan HaBavli, who was some sort of quasi-historian at the time. And the installation of the Exilarch, although it's a somewhat later text, a 12th century text, it really does illuminate in very vivid ways some of the unique aspects of this community. And if you take a look, at the actual record of the installation, this major event, right? The installation of the Reish Galuta, recently appointed to his position, it really gives a tremendous amount of insight and just a real great feel for some of the aspects of the community. Essentially, the letter describes various aspects of that installation. Will try to make sure that it's posted online together with the recording so anyone who could take a look can read really for themselves. But there are just numerous aspects of this, just the colorfulness. There are all sorts of formalities in terms of who would speak first, the Reish Galuta and the various Gaonim, and the way that the Gaonim at this ceremony defer to one another. The Gaon of Sura says, "You speak first." The one of Pumbedi says, no, you really can go ahead. And back and forth they go. This is a scene that we've seen prior. But what's actually also interesting is that despite their protestations, in fact, it's the Gaon of Sura who ends up speaking first. And not only does he speak first, but it would seem that he's probably the only one who actually speaks, at least the only one recorded speaking in this particular procession, in this accounting of the installation. And I think that between the lines, we start to get a sense as to the on the one hand, the institutional respect, and hopefully, and as a general rule, the genuine respect between the Gaonim, unless it was a particularly difficult time in their relationship, and yet at the same time, the question of the prominence of the two respective yeshivot, and the fact that in this particular case, at this time, between the lines, it does seem that this Gaon of Sura has a certain stature that is not designated to his counterpart from Pumbedisa, I think speaks volumes about the relationship between the yeshiva. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance in this entire event. It's really quite remarkable, and there are all sorts of really interesting aspects as well. So that, for example, the record that we see here, and it wasn't apparently, if you take a look, there's a footnote here as well that indicates that it wasn't just at this time or in this particular community where this was a common custom in Jews of Islamic communities in many places during the medieval period, but the addition of a bracha for the Reish Galuta in the middle of the Kaddish is something that's really very interesting and really noteworthy and really sticks out at you when you take a look through. Also, there are a number of comparisons between the Reish Galuta and the Caliph. Not only does there tremendous respect, mutual respect, and sort of this again, the balance between the formality and the genuineness. In other words, are these just formal ritual, as it were, behaviors or of respect and of procession that we find here, or does that also reflect a genuine respect? Hopefully the latter, although it's really hard to know for sure just based on this text, but really certainly clearly a very respectful set of interchanges between the Caliph and the Exilarch, and the way that the servants of the Caliph interact with the Reish Galuta and treat him with such dignity and respect is really very striking. But even the language of the letter comparing directly between certain aspects of the way that the Reish Galuta would never leave his home unless it was for some very special occasion, and even then he would be accompanied by a procession that was comparable to the procession that would accompany the Caliph when he would leave the palace. A lot of these comparisons, almost as if to say that the Jewish community, which is clearly semi-autonomous at this time, that the leader of that community, the political leader of that community, namely the Reish Galutz or the Exilarch, was in many ways the caliph of the Jews. And again, in terms of sort of the trappings of adopting the contemporaneous culture in ways that are, I think, are very typical and in this case seem generally healthy and resonate with the way that we integrate in any culture. Obviously, there's a core that we retain, and yet, in terms of many of those trappings, there can be all sorts of different, really interesting ways in which the dominant culture expresses itself, even in positive and just really and really thought-provoking and colorful kinds of ways. So that's something that's really evident from this text. It would have been fascinating to see if we had other installations or other ceremonies described, but we have what we have. It's medieval Jewish history, not modern Jewish history. We have numerous texts, but we only have so much, and they provide snapshots, but sometimes it's hard to know how representative they are, or whether there would have been all sorts of other interesting nuances had we had access to other primary texts, but we have what we have, and even after the finding of the Geniza, we're still quite limited in terms of the text from this time, certainly, of course, vis-a-vis relative to later periods in Jewish history, but it really is quite fascinating to examine a little bit more closely some of the texts that indeed we do have. Okay, that's with regard to this the installation, and just really interesting to see, at least on the processional or formal level, the interactions between the various religious and political leaders of the Jewish community at that time. Okay, we're now going to circle back to examine a number of the personalities, the outstanding personalities at this time. And we're going to look at just a couple for today, and then we'll continue with others in future weeks as well. Okay, so we're going to start with, we're going to go in chronological order. And the first of the Gaonim, the primary rabbinic personalities, we're going to examine just briefly. Most of them will be brief, with the exception of Rav Sadia Gaon in particular, who deserves really extensive treatment and discussion, which we'll give a quick introduction to him this week, and then we'll examine, God willing, more fully next time. But we're going to begin. The first of the personalities we'll look at is Rav Achoi Gaon. Rav Achoi Gaon lives in the 8th century. Interestingly enough, and this is telling as well, he is actually, he feels he was snubbed for the Gaonet, that he was not appointed to be a Gaon, and ultimately he makes his way to Eretz Yisrael, which has a small but still active community there in Eretz Yisrael, and that's ultimately what he does. Rav Achoi Gaon's still known colloquially as a Gaon, Rav Achoi's great contribution to the history of Halakha is his authorship of what's known as the She'iltos de Rav Achoi Gaon. Their She'ilot, notice the same language of She'ilot, they are not responsa in the traditional or full sense of the term that we would use nowadays. They aren't really a Halakha Lamasa, a practical Halakha question with an analytic and practical response, but they are structured, interestingly enough, and relevant to our discussion earlier, they are structured as sort of introductory questions with long excursus on particular halachic topics. The she'iltos are organized around the various parshiot hashavua. The classic printing that's generally widely used nowadays consists of three volumes, and it also includes a commentary of the Netziv, known as the Emek HaNetziv, which helped to make not only the Netziv's Pirush better known, the particular commentary, but also the She'iltos itself. It is structured around the Parshiot HaShavua and examines one or more mitzvot from each respective Parsha, starting with Pru or Vu, if I remember correctly, and going from there. The fact that it was published on the various Parshiot HaShavua, perhaps on the basis of shiurim of lectures that Rav Achoy had delivered at various points, is also perhaps something that contributes to the popularity of the work. And in that sense, it's sort of a fusion, an unusual kind of a blend between a work, a halachic work, that is structured as questions with answers, but actually on the Parshiot HaShavua. Shiltos is studied, is certainly studied nowadays, and certainly in many mainstream yeshivot. I would say that to study the Shiltos straight through is something that I think is relatively uncommon. I remember spending some time at Rabbi Moshe Tendler's shul in Muncie, and I remember he would give a shiurim from time to time. He would literally just go through the Shiltos, and every week he would pick a different Shilta and examine it, and he would read the Shilta and explain the simple pshat in the Shilta. It's written in a traditional Aramaic form, a substantial parts, and so he would just clarify the straightforward meaning of the Shilta, that particular Shilta, and then whenever there was something of interest, a chidush of some sort in the Shiltos, he would elaborate and examine it just a little bit more carefully. So that's in terms of Rav Achoy Gaon and his outstanding contribution, the Shi'iltos. The next personality we're going to look at, interestingly enough, is actually shrouded in some mystery. And this is the 19th century author of the Halachot Gedolot, which is an outstanding halachic compendium, known as the Bahag, the Baal Halachot Gedolot, very often quoted by the Baal Yatosvos and among other, and other Rishonim, classic pieces about Sirat HaOmer, and other areas of Halacha, reading the Megillah, in terms of women's obligation with regard to reading the Megillah, is another fairly well-known context in which the Bahag is very widely quoted. One of the fascinating things about the Bahag, which is again a sefer that we have nowadays, I believe it was edited by Rev Hildesheimer of 19th century German rabbinic fame, but the text is not fantastic, the one that's at least widely printed. But what's most intriguing and perhaps mysterious about the Bahag is that the author of this sefer, the name of this particular rabbinic personality, was not really widely known during the time of the Rishonim. Or to say it more precisely, it was actually subject to some debate. The Ashkenazic Rishonim from France and Germany, England as well, had a different set of assumptions as to who had authored the Sefer than as opposed to the assumption that was common among the Chachmei Svarad, among the Spanish Rishonim, the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva and others that we'll examine a bit later on. The assumption of the Chachmei Ashkenaz, of the Ashkenazic medieval scholars, is that the Bahag was authored by Rav Yehudai Gaon. That was their assumption. And so they'll quote the Bahag in the name of Rav Yehudai Gaon on a regular basis. The Chachmei Sfarad had a different working assumption. They generally took it for granted that the author was a lesser known name, but now a little bit better known, due to the discussion as to who the author was, and his name, that name is Rav Shimon Kiyara, in English spelled K or Q-E-Y-A-R-A, in Hebrew Kuf Yud Resh Aleph, Rav Shimon Kiyara, and that was the assumption of the Chachmei Svarad. As opposed to matters of Svara, where generally we say Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, where if you can make a plausible argument on either side, so there might be a certain degree of legitimacy that we assign to both sides, or all the various sides in a Machlokas. So there's a famous comment of Rashi in Maseches Ksuvos, in which Rashi says that may be with regard to matters of Svara, but if there's just a factual question, a historical question, as to who was the author of a particular halachic position, so then it's hard to say that that there's legitimacy to every position. In this particular case, consensus nowadays, academic and otherwise, is that the author was in fact Rav Shimon Kiara, and that in this particular instance, the Chachmei Svarad had gotten it right. It's just very interesting. Although the majority of the works of the Gaonim and their authors are widely known, it is quite interesting and I think is illuminating that throughout the medieval period, it was not necessarily clear to everyone who exactly the author was. And I think that that gives us some insight into the speed work of history, in that sometimes when we look back at history, once history has been written, we take it sort of for granted that things are fairly clear, but the retrospective way of looking at things to recognize that things were not always so clear, and that there are substantial periods of Jewish history, as any other history, that have shrouded in some degree of mystery, or at least certain aspects of them, I think is well illuminated in the case of the mysterious author of the Halachot Gedolot, the identity of the Behag. Okay. So that's the second personality, or personalities, that we're going to be looking at. And the third we're going to be examining is briefly Rav Amram Gaon. Rav Amram Gaon, also living in the 9th century, and best known for his Sidur, for Seder Rav Amram Gaon. This is really a foundational text, both in terms of study of the history of Tefillah, as well as just an understanding of how the modern Sidur came to be. Rav Amram Gaon's Sidur is widely available and really played an extremely crucial role in shaping the modern-day Sidur. So Rav Amram Gaon, who's quoted certainly far less often than, let's say, the Behag, and certainly studied in terms of the wider range of halachic areas than, let's say, Rav Achai Gaon, but certainly Rav Amram Gaon's mark was made in terms of his halachic contribution, certainly most prominently with regard to his work on the Sidur, which again remains extant and is oft studied as a critical text in this regard. Okay. So we have looked at Rav Achai Gaon, we've looked at Rav Shimon Kiara, the author of the Halachot Gedolot, and his work. We've looked at Rav Amram Gaon, his Sidur, and the fourth, and certainly the most prominent of the classical Gaonim that we're going to be looking at, is, of course, as I had mentioned already, Rav Sadia Gaon. And a quick introduction, then next week we will, God willing, look a little bit more closely really examining the life of Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon lives from 882 to 942, so he lives approximately 60 years. He's born in Egypt. Interestingly enough, as his opponents were very quick to remember, he's born to a non-rabbinic family. And yet, he clearly distinguishes himself as a brilliant young scholar from a relatively young age, what we would call really a Renaissance man in terms of the range of disciplines that he mastered, the range of Jewish disciplines, the range of Western disciplines, his mastery of halakha, his mastery of the Gemara, his mastery of Chumash, his mastery of Jewish philosophy, incorporating Jewish history, really just of Dikduk as well. And really he fused these together in absolutely brilliant ways, together with his extraordinarily strong writing abilities, which we'll come back to as we examine his life a little bit more carefully, and all of his Jewish learning alongside his mastery of secular disciplines, of general disciplines of study as well, general philosophy, mathematics, various aspects of science, really just an absolutely brilliant man whose intellect was really, really, really first rate in ways that just distinguished himself from, certainly from so many in his own generation and really, really well beyond. Rav Sadia Gaon also certainly one of the more colorful personalities of probably all Jewish history, certainly of the period of the Gaonim, and perhaps even throughout the medieval period. And he's a person who perhaps consistent with the strength of his intellect, was not afraid at all to speak his mind, no matter the consequences, and was a very strong personality, and on numerous occasions engaged in polemical dialogues, and really just very strongly worded exchanges with various prominent rabbinic personalities of his day and also political personalities. He was appointed the Gaon of Sura despite its declining authority in 928, and then he was later on appointed to the position of Gaon of Sura yet again, which of course indicates that at some point he lost that position. We're going to be looking at the incident that led to that. But really, Rav Sadia Gaon, through his brilliance, through the strength of his personality, through the remarkable output, he was really a furious writer in both senses of the term. He wrote very strongly and at times acerbically with regard to issues regarding the Karaites, as we'll see, but also a furious writer in the sense that he just had a remarkable output. In terms of his writing, in particular, during his later years. So we're going to pause here in terms of Rav Sadia Gaon, and next time we're going to be looking a little bit more carefully and examining some of the key moments in his life, his literary output. Look at that a little bit more carefully. His common denominators that really tie together all of his work, as well as some of his complex and really difficult series of interactions controversies between him and fellow rabbinic personalities, political personalities, as well as Karaite leaders of his day. After we conclude Rav Sadia Gaon, we're going to look at some others, other Gaonim, Rav Shrira Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon, and then move to some of the classical transitional figures toward North African and the Spanish. Jewish community is sort of the most prominent among the Sephardic communities, including personalities such as Rabbeinu Hananel, Rav Nisim Gaon, and in particular the Rif. And then we'll circle back to take a look at some of the cultural and other aspects of the period of the Gaonim that really lends other perspectives on this time period. And then we'll go from there. Thank you very much, and have a great day.